This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. We aim to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we speak with the Director of Public Affairs for the RAND Corporation, who is also an IMA with U.S. forces in Japan. She was formerly with the U.S. Space Force, and we take the opportunity to learn more about that organization. In the news, the aviation alphabet groups are unhappy with new tax proposals. We learn about a probable cause for the recent LATAM 787 sudden dive. Some results from the recent FAA production audit at Boeing are being reported. The NTSB plans an investigative hearing on the 737-9 MAX door plug blowout. Alaska Airlines had planned to take that 737 out of service the evening after the blowout. And JetBlue is getting an unfavorable response after a couple didn't get what they paid for. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 791 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and with me is first David Vanderhoof. He's our aviation historian from the American Helicopter Museum.
Hello, everyone. Looking forward to a out-of-this-world conversation tonight. And a shout-out to our newest Airplane Geeks listener, Little Oswald, who was born on March 5th. And Oswald will be a longtime fan, I guarantee you.
Wow. All right. Looking forward to hearing more about that. Also with us is Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk podcast. He's National CFI of the Year, and he's an expert on the Cirrus aircraft.
Hello, longtime listener, first-time caller. Oh, wait, no, that's
that's something else.
Something else. Hello, everybody. Great to be here. And I should mention that I'm signing in from LAX. I'm at a hotel right across the street down here in Los Angeles.
Wow. Are we gonna hear? Do you have a view of the plane?
I do. Yeah. In fact, I can see one that's headed for to the right, the North Complex, right now. In fact, I posted something on Twitter a few moments ago. I videotaped Lufthansa arriving, and I posted that on Twitter.
Cool. I love airport hotels for that reason. Also with us is our main man, Micah.
Great to be here, and I hope that I'm just not too spacey tonight is what I'm really concerned about.
Wow. Co-hosts are dropping clues right and left. So let's introduce our guest for this episode. It's Colonel Erin Dick. She's currently serving in both civilian and military roles. On the civilian side, she is the Director of Public Affairs for the RAND Corporation. Now, RAND, of course, is a nonprofit, nonpartisan research organization. They look to develop public policy through research and analysis. And her military position is IMA to the Director of Public Affairs, U.S. Forces Japan. Now, we'll talk about what an IMA is in a little bit, but her previous military assignments were for the Space Training and Readiness Command, Space Force, and the U.S. Space Command, that's Joint Combatant Command. Now, Erin is a communications and public affairs executive. She has more than 26 years of experience, including leadership positions with many different Fortune 100 aerospace defense and engineering and architecture firms. Erin is also a colonel in the U.S. Air Force Reserve, where she served for 26 years. She has an MA in Strategic Public Relations from George Washington University and a BA in English from Texas A&M University. Well, Erin, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here. And you get bonus points for saying reserve instead of reserves, which is what most people say, but it is a singular entity. So I am thrilled to be here. Thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah, we're excited too. Now, Erin is not currently in the U.S. Space Force, and she's not here speaking as a representative of the Space Force, but she does have some insights that will help us understand the organization, its mission, the people, the training. And we're also going to take the opportunity to learn more about that IMA I mentioned. It stands for Individual Mobilization Augmentee. Boy, there's a mouthful. It's a little-known volunteer position. This, Erin, this is a volunteer position. Is that correct?
It is, yeah. Just like the rest of our military, it's something that we opt to do.
And this is where part-time reservists serve alongside active duty forces. So there's some interesting information there, and Erin's going to share that with us as well.
But before we get to the news, Max, I need to give a big shout-out to Isaac Alexander, because I need to give him the credit and the thanks for introducing me to Erin through his Sunday night
100%.
Chats. And if it weren't for him, she wouldn't be here. So I want to give him the credit ahead of time and the blame if she ends up being a lousy guest.
Oh, boy.
Isaac is an amazing guy. Isaac Alexander, he knows everybody everywhere that has anything to do with aviation, it seems. And, of course, he hosts a group chat every Sunday night, which I haven't participated in a long time. I never seem to get it into my schedule. But he's the guy that I call the aviation geek's aviation geek. All right, but first we're going to launch into some of the aviation news from the past week. Our first item, this comes from the NBAA, and Rob surfaced this, and it's too bad he's not here, but this is Aviation Labor Coalition warns of harm from tax proposals targeting business aviation. Well, what we see is that President Biden recently unveiled the administration's fiscal year 2025 budget plan, and it includes increasing the aviation or the business aviation fuel tax 5 times, according to this story. The effect of that is pretty self-explanatory. And it also would reduce the depreciation schedule to 7 years from 5 years now for purchased business aircraft. So that's a little bit less obvious. Depreciation is a business expense, so you change the depreciation schedule, and that impacts the expenses that you can use to offset profits. So there's a tax implication there. The aviation and labor alphabet groups have expressed their displeasure. They've sent a letter to two committees, the U.S. Senate Committee on Finance and the House Committee on Ways and Means. And, of course, this is just a budget proposal, I guess. I mean, there's a long, long way to go. But the aviation groups really jumped on this right away.
Yeah, I think every few years the administration kind of looks at aviation and goes, oh, here's an easy way to raise some more money. And often it comes after, you know, some gaffe by, you know, someone in the aviation sector. So no surprise. But again, no surprise that the alphabets are opposing it. Any organization would oppose a new tax that targets just their particular industry. And I was kind of surprised to read the depreciation schedule changing from 5 to 7 years because, at least in small aircraft, in some recent years, they've had 100% bonus depreciation, where you could write the entire aircraft off in a single year. Wow. And in other years when it wasn't not so good, it was 50%, so you could write the entire thing off in 2 years. The most amazing thing about that was if you got your aircraft on December 31st and put it into some type of business use on that last day of the year, you could deduct 100% of the cost of that aircraft. And so, yeah, that was pretty darn generous, and maybe that's the reason the depreciation schedule is being challenged, being looked upon as a revenue source.
And one of the things that the article says, and this is something that needs to be thought of, is that the tax proposal, they say, that the aviation industry, the business aviation industry, supports 1.2 million jobs and contributes $250 billion a year to the gross domestic product. And sometimes when a proposal comes through, they kind of look at it statically as opposed to dynamically. And how would all the airports be affected and all the FBOs and all the people associated in and around the FBOs and the hotels and the restaurants and all those other things? So it truly needs to be considered in a totally dynamic analysis when the decision is made.
Another point that was made in the letter, and I think this is meant to address the possible, motivation for these changes, that rich, C-suite flyers are the beneficiaries of these business planes, and that's who's being targeted. But the letter points out that, and this is according to a Harris poll in 2018 that found that 85% of companies that rely on an airplane to meet their transportation needs are small and mid-sized enterprises. The passengers aboard a business airplane are typically technicians, and I'm reading from the letter, typically technicians, mid-level managers, and customers, not C-suite executives. And it's a pretty, you know, it's the usual suspects who signed this letter, and which went, I don't know if I mentioned this, but it went to the U.S. Senate Committee on Finance and the House Committee on Ways and Means. But the letter was signed by AOPA, the EAA, GAMA, the General Aviation Manufacturers Association, the IAM, the Union, the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers, the National Air Transportation Association, NBAA, NetJets Association of Shared Aircraft Pilots, and the Vertical Aviation International, VAI. Now, more on VAI a little bit later. That becomes kind of interesting. All right, moving on to our next item here. And if you were hoping that we would go an entire news segment without talking about Boeing, well, once again, you are wrong. A couple of articles. Boeing tells airlines to check 787 cockpit seats after mishap on LATAM flight. Micah, last week, we didn't really have any ideas as to what caused that 787 Dreamliner to take a nosedive and injure a number of passengers. But there's something interesting in the news now.
It seems that there is a cockpit pilot seat adjustment on the back of the seat, and there is a control for it with a closed cover over it that can sometimes, when it's pushed down, adjust the seat. And the idea came up that perhaps the one of the flight attendants was in the cockpit and leaned on the back of the seat and hit the cover and adjusted the seat that put the aircraft out of control as the pilot was moving forward and couldn't get a hold of the aircraft controls. Now, I'm wondering what happened with the first officer, or we don't know if this was the first officer or the pilot actually at this point, but what happened in the other seat and why it couldn't be controlled there. But it seems to be a really interesting place for a control, because if you're in the seat, you can't reach it. It's behind your neck, behind the your neck brace. I'm curious if anybody else has any ideas about it, Max?
Yeah. I did read about this. I knew nothing about this before the incident. But the button on the back of the seat is intended to be used when the seat is not occupied to move the seat back so that the pilot can climb in. And so I guess there are two adjustments. One, you know, which is for when you're in the seat, and that one on the back would be for people getting in and out of the seat.
The best thing I saw.
Go ahead, Aaron.
The best thing I saw on this was on Twitter, and it was a bunch of airplane pilots saying, "What? There are mechanical adjustments to seats? I need to be flying that airplane." And they talked about how the ritual is when the pilot and the first officer get in the airplane, the first 5 minutes is spent, you know, doing all kinds of acrobatics with your body to try to get the seat to manually adjust. So I didn't know there were electric, you know, adjustments on seats either. Sorry, David.
Oh, no, I was going to say, I mean, it. Maybe it's me, but it makes sense that, you know, if you're to be able to pull the seat back and get in it, I mean, maybe it's a little way too much of science fiction me, but if you watch them get into the Millennium Falcon, the seats turn towards the center aisle, so they're not hitting controls while they're getting in and out of the seats. But so the fact, I mean, this is not a Cessna we're talking about, and I would assume that a long-haul aircraft would all have that ability to prevent this from happening.
You know, we actually have something similar in the Cirrus Vision Jet. So there's a handle on the back so that as you're, you know, standing in the doorway, it's very easy to get that seat back, and then you just kind of hop into it. So you know, it's not totally, you know, unknown even in smaller GA aircraft.
Hmm. Well, Boeing has sent a memo to 787 operators, and they recommend inspecting the cockpit seats for loose switch covers. And they also in this memo instruct operators how to turn the power off to the pilot seat motor if necessary. And again, this is a motorized adjustment to the seat. It's not like a lever. It's motorized. But also, this has been a known issue. In fact, Boeing issued a bulletin in 2017 about this very same thing. So we'll see how it plays out. I don't think it's 100% verified that this is the source of the problem. And this is what caused the plane to take the dive. But based on the reports, it seems kind of likely. And we'll see. It doesn't sound like it's a mistake-proof design, which is really what you like. And we don't know if the airline had not paid attention to the bulletin from 2017, or if it had been forgotten, or what. But I think there's still a lot more investigating to take place here.
It's interesting, Max, you said it's not a mistake-proof design, because who's going to be reaching behind the seat to operate it while they're flying the aircraft? I mean, it sounds like that switch was designed to be operated only when someone was not occupying the seat. I'm going to give a pass on Boeing on this, especially if 2017 they sent out a NOTAM or a notice to all of the airlines, because I don't think this one's an entire Boeing fault.
Yeah, when I look at this, this really sounds to me like a kind of design issue that they overlooked, because you got to figure people come in and they lean on stuff, and I'm sure they didn't think about that. But it reminds me of when I was at the dentist, 4 or 5 years ago, and I'm sitting in the chair, and there's a patient who's standing in the hall talking with the dentist. And of all things, the switch to activate the x-ray machine is on the wall outside the door. Here I'm sitting in the chair, and I hear, eek. And this patient kind of leaned on the switch, and I got x-rayed, which is, again, just poor machine design.
Yeah. We have another item. This is a FAA audit of Boeing 737 MAX production reportedly found dozens of issues. I think we'd mentioned this kind of in passing, that the FAA was conducting an audit, a production audit. So the New York Times is reporting that in this recent FAA 6-week production audit at Boeing, that the airframer passed 56 tests and failed 33 tests, which is not a very admirable failure rate there. The New York Times is basing its reporting on a review of an internal FAA slide presentation. So I'm not sure how they got the internal FAA slide presentation, or if we know that it's a draft or an intermediate presentation or something. I guess we don't really know. But many of these failed tests centered around a failure to follow approved manufacturing processes, as well as a failure to keep proper quality control documentation. Well, that doesn't look good. And it just sort of adds more to the dumpster fire that seems to be, Boeing in the news these days.
What's most surprising about this to me is that there are 20 auditors on site at Boeing and about a half a dozen at Spirit AeroSystems. And so everyone, all the workers on the line had to know, hey, we're being audited, which to me says they were probably doing things more correctly that day than on days where they weren't being audited. And yet still they failed on a large number of these audits. They failed 33 out of 89, which means what? Over a third of the audits failed. And these are quality kinds of things. One of the things they cited was a mechanic was using a hotel credit card to do one check, and that they were using Dawn liquid soap. This is not a commercial for them, by the way, as a lubricant in the fit-up process, probably for the seals around the door. Which apparently was, not part of the standard procedure.
Yeah, the approved process can always change. If a clever employee somebody discovers a better way to do something, which might include using detergent as a lubricant or anything. There's a process to change the process, right? There's a way you can change the approved process. In aerospace, following the approved process is kind of king. And like I say, it doesn't mean that that can't be changed, but if you just never get around to changing the processes, now you've got a problem.
What surprises me is that a big company dealing with a crisis puts out a memo without thinking about the fact that it could go public. I mean, my advice to big companies going through crisis is don't put anything in writing if you don't want to see it on the front page of the New York Times. So, you know, memos leak. And, you know, I'm not there. So maybe they did have that conversation and know that this information might be leaked. But it's a lot of information to kind of put out there and knowing full well that it's going to be leaked.
You know, when it comes to the crisis management here, the actions that Boeing is taking or not taking to try to, you know, get a little ahead of this, I don't see a lot. Now, maybe there are things going on in areas that I don't have visibility, but I would think that a company like Boeing should be in full, not panic mode, but they should really be energized to try to deal with these issues, because it's just, you know, one thing after another, and this is impacting the perception of the company, at least in the public's eyes, if not the government's eyes.
They just seem to have it backwards. The parts that we're not hearing are the parts that they're keeping secret, and the parts that they're doing wrong, they're publicizing. It just seems to be totally the opposite of what they should be doing.
I'd be really surprised if they haven't hired a crisis PR firm. I mean, to me, this is just kind of the
I'm typical, available.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that is a thing. Smart companies do that when they get in trouble, and you know, the outside consultants help them work them through the process.
I can tell you, as a crisis communicator, half the battle is getting the principals to agree with the recommendations. I don't know what's happening at Boeing, but you can make all the recommendations of the world about what organizations should and shouldn't do, but ultimately, it's up to the C-suite to determine if they want to pursue those actions. I didn't mean to cut you off, Max.
No, that's right. I was just going to say, I think the other half of the battle that you've described is just getting them to even consider looking to the outside for help, because I think so many large companies, which are very complex, feel like, well, we've got the answers inside and people on the outside can't know our business as well as we do. That part is probably true, but you still need the expertise for things that you're not as smart about in a crisis.
The problem was, Max, you used the word smart in terms of smart companies, and we just don't see that happening right now with Boeing, unfortunately.
Max, you can edit that out, right? I don't want to say smart. No, I'm just kidding.
All right. I think it's one more on this. Maybe close to it. The NTSB is scheduled to hold an investigative hearing into the Alaska Airlines 737 door plug blowout on August 6th and 7th of this year, 2024. That's when the NTSB is going to hold this hearing, and they will accept sworn testimonies from witnesses as the NTSB determines the facts, the circumstances, the probable causes of this incident, and to make its recommendations. One fun thing about this, at least to my sense of humor, is that this hearing is going to be open to the public and live streamed. So it's not a two-way thing. You'll be able to watch the proceedings. You won't be able to interact or submit questions or make statements or anything of that sort. It'll be a listen-only experience. But I'm kind of excited. I'm going to block out August 6th and 7th, I think, if I can, and plan to watch that live stream. That'll be quite interesting.
I'm curious how the NTSB expects to be able to hold this kind of investigation, including subpoenas that it talked about, at the same time that the DOJ is investigating Boeing, and how they expect to get actual testimony that's going to be relevant to what they're doing, because Boeing is going to have to be very careful in terms of what they say. So I'm not sure how fruitful this is going to be, quite frankly.
Oh, so you're saying that with the DOJ investigation, that's going to cause people to clam up and maybe be less forthcoming with statements. It's sort of at odds. We've talked about this, and you have too, Micah. It's sort of at odds with the general approach to aviation incidents in the United States, where you know we don't look for blame, we look for causes and ways to address those causes so they don't happen again.
Yeah, and I would think that anybody testifying under this situation that's a part of Boeing would probably be saying, under the advice of counsel, I'm not going to answer that question. I'm really curious about this. I would love to get some feedback on this from people that might know better.
Now, the NTSB has an accident investigation webpage for this incident. And they've got videos of media briefings, some photographs. The preliminary accident report is there. Other related items are there. And we'll have a link to that in the show notes if you'd like to kind of follow along as the NTSB adds information to this accident investigation website. All right, I think this is the last item on this general topic. This is from the New York Times. And Micah, that exact Alaska Airlines aircraft had been the subject of some plans by Alaska Airlines.
Yeah, apparently the engineers had decided they wanted to take the aircraft offline to check the pressurization issue. It was well known that there was a pressurization issue, which is why the aircraft was taken off the Hawaii run and put on local runs in case there was a problem with pressurization. And so it was planned to be taken after this flight to Portland to be looked at from the Alaska Airlines maintenance procedure, but it wasn't. And so this article in the New York Times talks about, kind of from my perspective, sensationalizes the fact that it was going to be looked at for the pressurization issue, because the other thing that it does say midway down is that before an aircraft is taken out of service for this particular issue, that it needs to demonstrate the problem three times. And it only demonstrated it one time. And that's the typical protocol for Alaska Airlines, that pressurization light doesn't necessarily mean there's an issue with pressurization. It could mean there's a problem with the light. So it was going to go out after this particular flight, and they just let it fly one flight too long, apparently.
Things come up all the time, whether it's aircraft or, I don't know, any piece of machinery or computer equipment or, I mean, anything. Almost nothing runs 100% perfectly all the time. And in the case of aerospace, you have typically really well-documented procedures that guide you in looking at these kinds of discrepancies and deciding what do you do about it and when do you do it. And, I mean, you can argue, not here, but, I mean, it could be argued that Alaska Airlines, you know, maybe didn't have the right decision-making process in this case. I don't know. I'm not competent to say that. But the fact is that they did have a decision-making process, which they used, and they were going to let it fly and then take it out of service that night after it was done with its flights. And yeah, Micah, the New York Times kind of suggests that maybe Alaska Airlines should have taken it out of flight immediately, but again, that you really can't say that, because Alaska Airlines, apparently, as long as they're following their process for determining when you take something out of service, I mean, it's kind of good enough.
It's similar to why there is an MEL, a minimum equipment list, as to why, when you can take off and when you cannot take off, when the aircraft is ready to fly and what equipment is non-functioning or not there, where you cannot. And so if you have that minimum equipment list that is approved by everyone involved, this is sort of the same idea that the Alaska said when reporting in the New York Times that the warnings did not meet its standards for immediately taking it out of service. And that makes sense that they have, it's part of like almost like an MEL.
Though you got to say, pressurization, yeah, not a big deal, right? Oh, wait a minute. that is kind of a big deal. My guess is they'll probably change, you know, their standard, and who knows whether it'll go down to 2 times or 1 time. But, yeah, 3 times seems excessive for something related to something as important as pressurization.
All right. Enough on that incident. We talk about Boeing having difficult times with all the press they're getting these days, undesired press. But on a much smaller scale, JetBlue is also experiencing some kind of negative public reaction. Max, we had an elderly couple that had a little experience.
Yeah, indeed. And I just want to slightly reframe what you just said. It's not just bad press that Boeing's getting. There's some real problems that they're getting bad press about. But in this particular case, I guess I want people to think for a moment as I tell the story, what would be appropriate compensation? If you were running JetBlue, what would you offer this couple in compensation? And the story is that an 83-year-old couple, for their 60th anniversary, decided to fly from Boston to Southern California. This is going to be a kind of trip of a lifetime, go visit kids and granddaughter and so on. And so they splurged. They went with JetBlue's Mint Class, which boasts, quote, an exclusive sleep experience so they could get comfortable, get some rest for the Boston to Southern California flight, which they say can last up to 8 hours. That sounds a little long to me. But regardless, the cost for that experience is $5,200, which also surprised me. It seems like a lot of money to fly back and forth across the country. Well, here's what happened when they got on the airplane. The first time they boarded, if I could find it right here, they found that Wally's seat was stuck halfway upright, halfway between upright and flat. So his seat was stuck in the middle. And Meredith's seat was stuck completely upright. And so you think, well, maybe that's just a one-time experience. But guess what? On their return flight, problems again. Wally's seat was fully reclined, and Meredith's, once again, did not, it doesn't say did not what. But anyway, there were problems in both directions with both of the chairs. All right, so everyone is out there thinking about what the proper compensation is. JetBlue offered the pair, for their inconvenience and for not providing the experience advertised, $400 in JetBlue credit, which they said that really didn't provide much compensation for them because they never planned to fly that airline again. In fact, Wally said for us it was upsetting and demoralizing. And so JetBlue came back and they eventually up the offer to $1,200, again, in travel credit, not in any kind of refund on that. So anyway, as I read that, I just kind of thought, oh, man, if I were that couple, I would be really ticked off. I mean, that seems like pretty poor compensation for a very bad experience.
Yeah, those lie-flat seats are, I mean, this is not just a simple seat adjustment issue. The lie-flat seats are a big feature of this suite, basically, that, you know, allows you to sleep fully reclined, you know, very restful. It's a big part of the experience. Mint Class on JetBlue is, I mean, that's a nice setup.
Mint Class on JetBlue is known to be the best U.S. domestic first class seat available, better than anybody else's. The Mint Class suite is absolutely fabulous, and it's individual suites. Now, what I thought was really interesting about this is that if you're in coach and the seat doesn't fully come up, the plane can't take off. And you're certainly not allowed to take off the aircraft with a seat with somebody lying flat. It can't happen. So I don't know why these two people were even allowed to fly, or why the seats weren't taken out of service. This is the kind of thing you expect. If Brian were here, I would say this is the kind of thing you expect on United. It's just a horrible situation for these two people out of New Hampshire.
You lost me at they're going to Southern California as a trip of a lifetime. You lost me right there. And that's as somebody who lived in Los Angeles for 15 years. So,
yeah, it seems, I don't know what the process is in JetBlue for determining compensation when the service provided falls short of what's advertised. So I don't know, was this some sort of low-level person making these offers? I don't know. That would be interesting to know how does JetBlue deal with these kinds of situations? Is this a one-off because somebody just – the wrong person was involved in making this decision? But, yeah, it is particularly
You mean the roulette wheel of low digits that they spin in the office doesn't work?
Yeah, I guess not. But, yeah, and it's particularly galling to this couple because, like you said, Max, they'd already decided that they were never flying JetBlue again. So, I mean, something simple kind of blew up in JetBlue's face, I think.
Well, and again, going back to crisis communication, what I would advise in a situation like this is, you know, how much does it cost? I don't know how many column inches this article took up, but how much does it cost to buy a full page ad or whatever in the Daily Mail? My guess is it's probably quite a lot, not to mention the fact that it's just really bad PR. So, you know, them trying to be chintzy really is resulting in a lot of reputational damage, which is much, much higher cost than just compensating them appropriately.
You know, there's a real missed opportunity here for the other airlines. In typical newsjacking fashion, the right thing to do would be for United to step up and say, hey, we're offering this couple free first class trip to Southern California again. I mean, to me, that would be brilliant.
Yeah. And ultimately low cost when you consider everything.
David Neelam is probably rolling over in his grave. Oh, wait, he's still alive. And JetBlue let him go. Boy, what a mistake.
All right, again, we're speaking with Colonel Aaron Dick. Aaron, we're really thrilled to have you on the show. There's so many things we could talk about with you, so we'll focus on a few things. But one thing that certainly we wanted to kind of poke at some was the U.S. Space Force, which I think has an interesting and pretty short history. But again, you're not speaking as a representative, but through your involvement, maybe you can tell us a few things about the mission of the Space Force. Why do we have a Space Force?
I consider myself a groupie. I consider myself the number one fan. So I do not, unfortunately, wear a Space Force patch on my uniform. I am still a proud airman, but a huge supporter, as Micah knows, and a huge defender in some cases of the U.S. Space Force and the U.S. Space Force mission. You know, you talked about it being new. The truth of the matter is the Department of Defense has been involved in, you know, working in the space domain since the beginning of space exploration. Back in 1954, I think it was when General Schriever was kind of put in charge of space operations. And then in 1982 was when the Air Force Space Command was activated. So the Space Force itself is new, but the Department of Defense keeping an eye on space as what until very recently has been a benign domain, you know, one that was primarily used for exploration and scientific research and things like that. Back in 2019, and really before that, there was beginning to be an awareness or, I guess, an understanding that while we, the United States, might consider space a domain environment, our adversaries were looking at ways to exploit it and make it a contested domain. And so, quite frankly, what it came down to is as our adversaries continued to make it a contested environment, it became a bigger mission than just the Air Force could continue to do as its own service. And so the idea behind the Space Force was this is an Aaron analogy. It's kind of like if you go back to the Army Air Corps, right? Like at some point, somebody made the decision that air dominance was really, really important, and maybe we should pull that out, and it shouldn't belong to the Army anymore. It should have its own branch.
That's a great analogy, yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, you've got Air Force commands who are looking at their critical areas of responsibility, whether that's fighters or mobility or training or whatever. And space is just too important for it to be something that the Air Force just kind of keeps its eye on. And so it really comes down to just a recognition that our adversaries are making it a contested domain, and we're not going to sit by and just let that happen.
So was the Space Force pulled out of the Air Force, or were there other new components or people or resources added to it to create it?
That's a great question. So, you know, what a lot of people don't know about the Space Force is that the Space Force itself is really still quite small. So the people who wear that blue Space Force name tape or that blue, you know, PVC patch on their shoulder, there's really only three career fields that make up the Space Force right now. It's satellite operations, so the people who fly the satellites, cyber, and space intel. So the Space Force itself consists of kind of those three operational capabilities pulled out of all the services, right? So you had soldiers who were doing satellite operations, you know, in the Army, who are now changing their patches and becoming guardians. There are a lot of people like me who support the Space Force because I'm not satellite ops, cyber, or intel, unfortunately. Yeah. I am public affairs. So there's a lot of us support folks, weather, medics, public affairs, lawyers, you know, finance people, contracting, acquisitions. All those people are still in the Air Force. And so it's still quite nascent as a force in the respect that they're primarily focused on those three operational missions. Now, obviously, there's a lot of organizations and people who are supporting the Space Force. They may not wear the patch, but they are dedicated. You know, they work full time for the Space Force, like I did when I was assigned to them.
Can you give us some examples? If you were trying to describe this to the common man, you know, the common person on the street, why should they care about a Space Force? Maybe are there some specific examples of, you know, what the Space Force might do or does do that would impact the general public?
This is one of my favorite questions to answer, or one of my, I guess, my favorite topics to talk about, because as is the case, has been the case with the U.S. military for decades and decades, really until 9/11, which was kind of the first time that we've been attacked on our own soil. Because we have had assured access to space basically forever, and it has never been directly challenged by anybody, we have the luxury of taking it for granted. And so when you look, you know, when I was at U.S. Space Command, the motto was never a day without space, because literally global financial systems, commerce, we're talking oceanic shipping, rail operations, transportation, medicine, finding a lost pet. I mean, the fact that our pets have chips in them now and we can be reunited in a matter of minutes. Ordering DoorDash, not quite as important as, you know, medical, but really important to a lot of people, not to mention the terrestrial warfighting support. So, you know, all of our warfighters here on Earth, Navy, Air Force, Coast Guard, Homeland Security's mission, they need space. They need space to do their mission. In order for us to be dominant in every terrestrial domain, we need space. And so it's not Velcro and Tang anymore. And the thing is, because the military to date has done a good job of deterring and preparing for, you know, a potential contesting of the space domain, people take it for granted. You know, I have said before that I wonder if maybe, like, it's going to take a space 9/11 for people to realize and appreciate how important it is. I certainly hope not. And I certainly hope that, you know, the people in decision-making positions, you know, continue to provide and equip and fund the Space Force in a way that enables us to maintain our superiority so that never happens and that we have the redundancies that we need. But I think it's very easy to take for granted that it is now a contested warfighting domain, and our adversaries would really like to deprive us of that ability.
Can you give us an example of what a Space 9/11 might be? Just some examples that it would really jolt the public's awareness into why this is important.
Yeah, I mean, what I can tell you is to think about other domains, right? I mean, space. So U.S. Space Command's domain is 100 kilometers above the Earth to infinity. All right, it is a huge domain. But at the end of the day, it's just another domain. And when you think about land and air and sea, so for example, we have seen China and Russia both demonstrate direct ascent anti-satellite missile tests. So these are called DAA-SAT. The U.S. has signed a moratorium that we will not conduct these tests, because essentially what this is a terrestrial missile that can go into low Earth orbit and take out a satellite, right? Now, might be a great offensive capability, but it also creates millions of pieces of space debris that now has to be tracked and is really a very irresponsible act. So, but if you just think about that, like think about the capability of shooting satellites into a million bits from the ground. There are ground-based lasers, there's jamming, there's, cyber capabilities. Those are all the types of threats that are in open source that our adversaries have already demonstrated they're capable of.
We talked a little bit about this a couple of weeks ago. The idea of the global positioning system being taken out is going to disturb commerce completely all worldwide. The idea of even the Japanese, we talked about cleaning up satellite debris, and the Japanese had a system to do that. I think we talked about they can't do it because the idea of cleaning it up could also be used offensively to destroy it. I think that's where the Space Force comes in. And part of, I think, what you said earlier, and please correct me if I'm wrong, Aaron, as you always do. but I think, like the analogy to the U.S. Army Air Corps and the Air Force, the Space Force actually existed prior to its inception as a Space Force. It was just part of all these other organizations. And what we are doing is uniting them together with one particular mission and hopefully one budget, so there's not infighting among the rest of the Air Force or the Army or the Navy trying to get budget to handle these issues.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, it's putting like capabilities together for economies of scale and for more effective multi-domain capability. And the same holds true for our allies and partners, right? It's not just, when I was working for U.S. Space Command, I had the awesome privilege of traveling to the U.K. for the stand-up of the U.K. Space Command. So it's not just us coalescing like capabilities across the Department of Defense into one force, but it's also beginning to see, beginning to have our allies and partners do the same thing so that we can be a united, multi-nation capability that will really challenge our adversaries.
And I think the issue is, or part of the issue is that it was when the Space Force was formed, it was not explained very well to the general public in terms of what it was doing, why it was being formed. I won't go into the political details of perhaps why that happened, but it's still not very well explained. Plus, the Space Force, whoever was in charge of it, kind of made a parody of themselves. Guardians, I think Pitchers and Catchers reported a couple of weeks ago. And I know you're a big baseball fan, Aaron, so you know what I'm talking about. But the Cleveland Indians are now the Cleveland Guardians. Also, it's just a very strange name for the Space Force. And then the uniforms are a bit unique, kind of looks like you're watching a bad Star Trek impersonation. And then the Space Force song. It's just
there's a song? I didn't know
there is indeed.
Like, you know, the Wild Blue Yonder for the Air Force, the caissons go rolling along. There's a Space Force song, and it is hysterically awful.
Well, we're going to have to find that.
Yeah. Doing all that just makes it seem like it just makes it funny. It makes it a laugh. It's too easy to make jokes about. And Max, I'm sorry, I didn't want to interrupt you.
Yeah. No. I wanted to add that, there was just unfortunate timing for the Space Force that a movie came out at the same time. Just dumb luck with that name kind of parodying it, I think, even before it was created. So the timing was just totally unfortunate.
Yeah. I mean, listen, I was not part of the team that the public affairs team that designed the rollout. I certainly am not criticizing what they did in any way. However, I will say, I worked at Starcom and the Buzz Lightyear jokes, I was there for them. I was there for them. You know, I think that, you mentioned the political piece, and I'm certainly not going to get into, the rightness or the wrongness, but everything is polarized these days. Literally everything is polarized, hot dogs, with mustard or ketchup. Like, you could divide a nation based on that.
Yeah, so clearly it's mustard.
Clearly, unless you're on the ketchup, in the ketchup camp. So, I think, you can't dismiss that, Micah. You can't dismiss the fact that it was Trump who was the commander in chief at the time the Space Force was stood up, because he's a polarizing figure. Again, not making a political statement, but I don't think you can ignore that. I have friends in my circle who are on the more liberal side who have opinions about the Space Force simply because of that. So I don't think we can ignore that. I mean, that's the reality. And I don't know, honestly, in hindsight, what we could have done differently. Now, the uniforms and the Guardians and all that, I hear what you're saying. And, maybe there are ways that we could have leveraged that more to help tell our story. Maybe we could have, I don't know, hindsight's 2020, right? But what I will tell you is that Guardians has been in the lexicon of DOD space for decades. It's not new. And I happen to like it. I mean, I'm, like I said at the top, I'm Space Force's number one fan. So I happen to like the distinction between airmen and Guardians. But yeah, I know Guardians of the Galaxy, right? Like, it's like a built-in joke, just ready to happen. So I certainly understand it. I personally have leaned into it to the degree that I'm not, marginalizing what I do. But I also spend a lot of time talking about the threat and the reality of that threat, and the reality that if we don't have the Space Force, whatever you want to call it, and whatever clothes they're wearing, we would be in big trouble.
Aaron, is there specialized training for members of the Space Force? Did something have to be created in order to to make these folks effective?
So I'm so lucky. I've had so many amazing experiences in my 26 years. And after being in 26 years, it's you don't think you're going to do something new. You've kind of done everything, whether you're doing it for Air Mobility Command or whether you're doing it for Air Force Special Operations Command. It's all kind of the same, different platforms, different, audiences maybe, but the year that I was at Space Training and Readiness Command, this is exactly what we were focused on, was establishing the doctrine and the training to really shape Guardians into Guardians. And I will tell you, as a lifelong airman, I was skeptical. I was like, really? I mean, really, it's just airmen in different uniforms, right? No, it is not. I was part of the standing up. Let me rephrase that. I had nothing to do with standing it up. A bunch of people stood up the first basic training flight that was all Guardians. I got to be there with the press to tell the story. I can't take any credit for it. But, this was the first flight. Up until this point, the Guardians were training, going through basic training with the airmen. So they were learning airmen core values, and they were learning airmen competencies, and they were studying Air Force doctrine. this was the first flight of all Guardians who were led by Guardian MTIs. The military training instructors were Guardians, and they were using a Guardian curriculum that focused on the Guardian values, which are the four C's: character, connection, commitment, and courage. And having spent a week with this flight, it was so clear to me that we were building different people. Let me give you an example. I love this story. So all these MTIs were the military drill instructors, okay? The guys, the people with the hats that look real mean, and they're just amazing, amazing professionals. So they're all now Space Force. And so one of the flights had gone to get haircuts. And I don't know if they finished early, but something happens. And rather than waiting for one of the MTIs to go pick them up and march them back, the flight leader, Guardian cadet in training, made the call, because it was really hot outside and they were standing around waiting, just to march back to the dorms without the leader, right? So this flight starts walking by, and all the MTIs are like, "What? They're not supposed to be back. Why are they back?" And so there was this debate among the MTIs about, do we discipline them, right? Because the thing is, in the Air Force, you have a lot of different specialties who do a lot of different things. Chain of command is incredibly important. Following orders is incredibly important. It is in the Space Force too. However, if you are sitting at a console and it is a young Guardian who is maybe straight out of tech school, a lieutenant, and a tech sergeant, all three of those people are in charge of that multi-billion-dollar exquisite satellite. That young Guardian needs to have the courage, which is one of the values, to speak up and take action if they see something that is wrong. And so the MTIs were standing around going, do we discipline them? Do we not discipline them? How does this fit in with courage and commitment? Because technically, they looked at what was best for the flight. It was 100 degrees outside. They were standing in the heat. They made the decision to march the flight back. And so what they ended up doing was telling them, it was good that you took action. There was ambiguity in your guidance, so you made the right decision. Hmm. But even in and amongst themselves, they had to figure out, like, sitting at a console flying a multi-billion-dollar exquisite satellite, how would we feel if this young Guardian made this unilateral decision to protect their people, right? It's just fascinating. So the short answer, Max, is yes, it is different. It is different doctrine. It is different culture. It's more than just different uniforms. It's still evolving. The doctrine is not done. I mean, this is something that Starcom is responsible for, and this will be happening for the next several years.
I was going to say, Aaron, we've talked a little bit about the Space Force, and we're starting to slowly run out of time, but tell us a little bit about you. You're a colonel in the Air Force Reserve, which is not an easy thing to do. You've done a whole bunch of other incredible things. And, I mean, you're an inspiration to me, and I'm, and I'm sure to many other people. But how did you get to where you are? What brought you there in terms of – you're also a private pilot, if I remember correctly. So tell us a little bit about all of that.
Yeah, so I got the aviation bug really young. My dad is a recreational pilot, 152s, 172s, things like that. So I got the bug really young, joined at the time Boy Scout Explorers. I think it's called something else now. But I grew up in Dallas-Fort Worth, right next to the American Airlines headquarters, and joined Explorers. And it was really kind of a freak thing that our scout leader or scout master or whatever was a captain for American, and he had a 152 that he didn't fly very much. And so we brokered this deal. I was about 16, that if I would take care of his airplane, he would teach me how to fly. And all I had to pay for was fuel. And by the way, his airplane had been converted to 80 octane instead of 100 low lead. So it was like $1.50 a gallon. I didn't realize at the time what a great deal this was, right?
Yeah.
Until I suddenly became very cheap labor for him. I was changing brakes. I was laying grass at his house. It extended well beyond the airplane, but I worked for that license. But yeah, we would fly two sorties a day, early morning and in the evening during the Texas summer when it would stay light late. And yeah, I got my pilot's license when I was 17 years old, which is kind of crazy to think about now. I can't believe my parents let me do that, but they did. Wait, I was so hard-headed.
I got to interrupt you in terms of being hard-headed. You are feisty, and one of the things I really love and admire about you is the fact we get into arguments all the time, and they're great, fun arguments. But tell us about that first cross-country and your ATC experience.
Oh, yeah. So, you know, rural Texas, right? A lot of women, young women, were not flying back then, certainly not in rural Texas. And I sounded like a 17-year-old. I sounded like a child. And I was on my three-legged cross-country. This was pretty soon before I was supposed to be getting my license. And so this was one of my three-legged cross-countries. And I had just been kind of chased off track by a storm. And this was when we still had to use paper maps. And my cockpit management was a bit of a mess. And I was kind of stressed out. And so I finally am approaching my third leg, and I'm coming in, and I call ATC, and you know, Cessna 524 Mike Echo, and you know, downwind, you know, and he gives me clear to land, and then he says, "Does your dad know that you're flying? Does your dad know that you're?" And I mean, look, I'm a feminist, right? I didn't know I was a feminist back when I was 16, but apparently it was in me somewhere. Because I said, Cessna 524 Mike Echo, clear to land, and I don't think that's any of your business. I was livid. I was so livid. Now, I will say when I landed, I made peace with the old gentleman who put gas in my car. And he's like, we don't get little girls like you out here very often. And told me they'd clear the cows off the runway before I took off. You know, they were very, very nice gentlemen. But yeah, you know, it's, you know, it was unusual back in the day, and I'm quite proud of it. But yeah, I went to Texas A&M, got my degree in English, like one of the only people ever to get a degree in English from the Agricultural and Mechanical College of Texas. Joined the Air Force because I didn't really know what to do with an English literature degree. I was on active duty for 10 years. I actually had a clean break out of the military, and I went straight to work for Bell Helicopter, where I was the communications manager for the V-22. At the time, this is when it was still in development and test at Pax River. Talk about crisis communication. I cut my teeth a lot on crisis comms. And about a year into that job, I got a call from a friend and mentor of mine who was the director of public affairs at AFSOC. And he said, how would you like to come stand up the first CV-22 squadron at AFSOC? And I was like, that sounds amazing, but I feel like it might be a conflict of interest because I'm the communications director at Bell Helicopter. And he said, oh, no, no. To be clear, you're going to have to quit your job. You're going to have to join the reserve, and you're going to have to move to Florida. Yeah. And I said, why not? and that's how I joined the reserve. I call myself an accidental reservist because that was not part of my plan. And of course, 16 years later in the reserve, I'm quite grateful for that. But I've just been, you know, I've had some really wonderful assignments, great mentors and teachers, and my corporate life has, you know, mirrored a lot of what I have done in the military. And it's just been a great ride.
And what is an IMA? Tell us about that.
Yeah, so it's I call it the best kept secret in the Air Force. I mean, essentially, there are three different kinds of reservists. There's the one that most people know about, which is called a traditional reservist. They do 1 weekend a month, 2 weeks a year. It's a bunch of reservists who are part of a unit, right? They all train together. They all do their medical stuff together. Their physical fitness test together. They deploy together as a reserve group. Then there is what we call AGR, which are reservists who are assigned to reserved units, but they're active duty. They're full-time, right? So they wear uniforms. They're not 2 weekends a month or 1 weekend a month, 2 weeks a year. They're full-time working for a reserve unit. And then there's what's called the IMA. And an IMA is essentially a backup to the active duty. So we are assigned directly to the active duty. We are not assigned to a reserve unit. So for example, my current assignment, I am the IMA to the Director of Public Affairs for U.S. Forces Japan. So when my boss needs to leave for a month, if he needs to go home to the States, you know, to visit family, if he gets deployed, if he has to go somewhere, I step in and it's basically plug and play. I just real quickly, I have a funny story on this because I just came back from Japan and I had to go to Ichigaya, which is the Japanese Pentagon essentially. And business card culture is very important in Japan and lots of Asian countries. And so the host nationals that work in our office said, you know, you need business cards. You need to have business cards before you to go to Ichigaya. And so they were trying to figure out that the host nation locals were trying to figure out what to put on my business card, right? Because I'm not the director of public affairs. I'm the IMA to the director of public affairs. And so they were trying to figure out, and they don't have reserve in Japan. And so I hear all this chatter in the back and they're talking and then they come out, and they're like, we got it. It's, and I don't know what the full word is, but the short version is Yobi, Y-O-B-I. And so they're like, yep, that's it. And I'm like, okay, well, like, what does that mean? And they said it means spare. So, and I was like, you know, that's kind of true. I am the spare for when my boss goes away. But yeah, I love it because, you know, we are still only required to do the 30 or 40 days a year, but we are directly assigned and attached to the active duty. So it keeps me really close still to, you know, to the active duty and what's happening on the mission front.
So, I mean, you're also employed by RAND. I mean, how do they give you up for these periods of time?
Yeah, they do. I mean, look, RAND is a defense contractor, right? I mean, the DOD is one of our biggest clients. And as all my employers, you know, Pratt & Whitney and Aerojet Rocketdyne, they've all been, I mean, first of all, it's a federal law, right? Like, they're required to let me do my time. However, you know, some employers can make it really painful for their reservists if they wanted to. All of the companies I've ever worked for, including RAND, are very, very generous. They do give me up. You know, they give me up for the time I'm gone, and then I come back and plug back in. So, you know, on the weekends, I'll check in on email just so I'm not completely underwater when I get back. But yeah, RAND is just incredibly supportive of my military service, which I'm very grateful for.
You may not be able to comment on this, but I'm going to ask you anyway, and you'll just say no comment.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
You were in Japan in this position, I think, when the Air Force, the CV-22 went down, and you have a background in the CV-22 as well. Were you involved in that in any way that you can tell us a little bit about?
Yeah, no, that's a great question, Micah. So that actually happened in November. I was on duty for the last month. It's funny because, so, you know, they are working, and this includes all the services that fly the V-22, including Japan, which has four V-22s. They are currently looking at their path to return to flight, right? The fleet has been grounded since, I think it was December when it was grounded. So I was actually hoping that would happen while I was there because I really wanted to be part of helping tell that story about return to flight. So I was involved in, you know, developing some of the public affairs guidance and some of the messaging and things like that. But, I wasn't there for the actual implementation. I did get to go to the memorial service, which was, incredibly hard and incredibly inspiring at the same time. But one of the things I reflected on was how the V-22 has been part of my life for as long as the V-22 has been in existence. I mean, I have worked on this platform since it was still in development and test in my corporate job. So, that was an awful, awful tragedy. Although I will tell you, based on the memorial service, they all perished doing exactly what they love to do, and they wouldn't be doing anything else. No consolation to their families probably, but it was a beautiful memorial. And I very much hope that the platform will return to flight very, 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 very soon because our warfighters need it.
We actually just talked about that last night in Isaac's chat, and it is operational again.
Okay, good. I hadn't seen that. That must have happened in the last couple of days. So I'm really happy to hear that.
All right. Well, Aaron, just to put a bit of a bow on it and just return back to the Space Force. When you look into the future, what do you think we can expect to see? I imagine that there's going to be a growth of capability and responsibility and all, but what do you see?
I'm very excited to see what happens. I know that you guys were tracking General Saltzman's comments during AFA back in February. You know, they've already talked about a new Space Futures Command. So Space Force currently has three commands: Space Systems Command, Space Operations Command, and Space Training and Readiness Command, or STARCOM, where I worked. So we are now going to have a fourth one called Space Futures Command. And essentially, they're looking at the long-term developing the capabilities that they need to continue to maintain our advantage in space. So I'm very excited to see that. I know that also during those remarks, they talked about creating a new warrant officer position, which I love the idea of that just because I love warrant officers. I learned some of my best lessons from Army warrant officers. So they tell it how it is with no sugar on top. So I love the idea of that to bolster, you know, some of our critical cyber and IT capabilities. Yeah. And I think you'll just see us continue to grow, continue to focus on ensuring that we have the capabilities that we need. That includes partnering with other nations. I think you're going to see additional countries stand up space forces, space commands. I think we'll see even more partnership with industry and academia. That's something I think the Space Force has done really, really well. They really have been deliberate about not trying to look at the Air Force and see how it could be adapted, but rather look at a blank sheet of paper and say, is there a better way? Like, this is the easy way, but is there a better way? Should we partner with industry, who has already, I mean, industry has been, has, they're really far ahead of the DOD in a lot of ways. You know, they have the agility and the flexibility. And so I think, you know, it's going to be exciting. I mean, every year is a year of firsts, you know, every year is a year of firsts, every year is a year of milestones being achieved. And I think we'll see that for the foreseeable future.
Aaron, it's been really wonderful speaking with you. When we talked the other day, I mentioned that after, you know, looking at your resume, this the depth of experiences is just phenomenal. I hope we have an opportunity in the future to bring you back and talk about some other things. We'd really look forward to it. So again, Colonel Aaron Dick, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really fun. Appreciate it.
What's up with the geeks? Let's see, Mr. Trescott, what's new in your world?
Well, let's see. I'm just finished up a current episode of Aviation News Talk, which would be 319. And then I talked about a crash that hasn't gotten a lot of publicity, but a jet crash just short of the runway in Hot Springs, Virginia last week. And what's really amazing about it is that's the third fatal business jet crash within a five-week period. So it looks like we're on a hopefully this trend doesn't continue because this is a high number of jet crashes in a pretty short period of time. So I talk about what we know about that particular crash. Also, I had a lot of feedback from people about the United Flight 2477 taxiway overrun in Houston. I had several different airline pilots who provided some pretty interesting feedback on that. And they were also talking about their airlines, FOQA programs, the flight operations quality assurance programs, and how data would have been reported automatically about what looked like to be a fairly non-standard approach to the runway, which probably didn't meet the airline's requirements to land in the first 3,000 feet of the runway. So a variety of different things talked about.
All right. Very good. Hey, where do we find that?
Oh, of course, aviationnewstalk.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right. Didn't want to move on without you plugging the show.
Sure.
All right. And Micah, news with you?
Yeah. This week, Brian and I released episode 68 of the Journey is the Reward podcast. And our guest is Matt Smith, one of the co-hosts of Plain Talking UK. And I actually listened to it today because I wondered how it came out. And Brian had a lot of editing to do, but it was a fun show. And the interesting part about having Matt on as a guest is he's the only aviation podcaster I know that hates to fly and is really afraid of it. And that's really what we focus on. What we talk about is his fear of flying and where it came from and how he overcame it.
Yeah. Good. I saw it pop up in my podcast app. Aaron, you just came from Japan. How was your flight experience? Have a great flight?
I had a terrific flight. I cannot complain. I had good tailwinds, so it was a fast flight across the ocean. I can't complain. I flew internally, domestically. I flew a few Japanese airlines, and that was a wonderful experience. Yeah, I'm not going to compare it? Them. I'll just say
it's different.
Japanese domestic airlines are very comfortable. All my flight experience have been great. No complaints.
All right. Let's see a couple of shout outs. Micah, you've got something for us.
Yeah. On Apple TV, if you get it, there is a show called Masters of the Air. And, it tells a story of the 100th Bomb Group during World War II, that was stationed up in East Anglia in the UK. And it follows them through it's all true stories, these incredibly dangerous and right, terrifying missions to destroy targets inside Germany. And they started off before there was any kind of fighter coverage, and then went on to even include some of the work they did with the Tuskegee Airmen. It was just fabulous. The ninth and final episode of the series came out on March 15th. I waited for that, and over the weekend I watched all of them, and it was just incredible. It's the U.S. Army Air Corps version of Band of Brothers or The Pacific, and also executive producers were Tom Hanks and Steven Spielberg, and I can't recommend it highly enough. A couple of times it had me in tears, a few times it had me kind of laughing, but you could feel just how visceral that whole situation was. Really a great show, and highly recommend it.
And that's on Apple TV?
Yes, it is.
And my wife bought me that book. I just finished it. It's amazing. The level of detail that they go into is phenomenal. One of the things that surprised me was they mentioned some of the people and where they were from. One guy was from a small town 13 miles from where I grew up. Another one was from a town about 25 miles down the road in northern Pennsylvania. So just a tremendous amount of detail. And really, it really hit me how bad the 8th Air Force had it in the early days. The losses were just amazing. I mean, in terms of the percentage of the force that was lost, it kind of rivaled German submarine losses, which I think something like 88% of those people didn't survive. This wasn't quite that bad, but in the first couple of years, I think they said the odds of finishing your 25 missions was something like 1 in 3. So pretty poor odds.
And the other thing that they portrayed really well, and it kind of like in Catch 22, which did it in a funny way, but this was really happened, is that it was 25 missions, and then in the middle of it, they raised it to 32 missions while they were in the middle of flying, which was just awful. There were men that thought they were going to go home and found out that they weren't.
All right. We have a little bit of listener mail, and we heard from David. Not our David, another David. And he says, hi, guys. It's been a long while. As far as movies go, Toward the Unknown, 1956, starring William Holden, James Garner, his first movie, I guess, Lloyd Nolan, Charles Lee, and Murray Hamilton, among others. He says it's about test pilots, of course, the Korean War and PTSD, although that's not what they called it at the time. He says, the main star to me is the Martin XB-51, starring as the Gilbert XF-120. David, are you familiar with those aircraft?
The B-51's kind of an interesting aircraft because it was a three-engined bomber that was going to be a medium bomber and a night attack bomber. It lost out to the British Canberra, and then Martin produced the Canberra, but it was a very unique layout. The B-51 had a bicycle landing gear, so it had two sets of main gear and then ones out on the wings, that outriggers out on the wings. It also had cheek mounted engines directly behind the cockpit. The wings were shoulder mounted, so you normally would think you'd see the engines on the wings, but they wanted cleaner aerodynamics. So you get kind of an odd shaped aircraft, and of course the other part about it was underneath the T-tail was a third jet engine, which had an intake that came from the top down, kind of kind of the same kind of ductwork that was like in an L-1011, a Lockheed L-1011, but it was definitely ahead of its time and might have actually been a very successful bomber, but there's a lot of also political intrigue that occurred with the whole Canberra and Martin. But yeah, it's always been one of my favorite airplanes because it's different, and it's definitely that 50s vintage where we're going to try everything.
Yeah, listener David continued there. He said there are numerous other vintage 50s aircraft. He said Chuck Yeager did much of the flying for the movie, and there's a scene in the Edwards Air Force Base Officers Club where test pilots signed part of the wall. He says, I think, it's been a while. And one can see Yeager's name, Scott Crossfield, Bill Bridgman, and Ivan Kinchlow, Korean War ace, incredible test pilot and victim of the original downward-firing ejection seat of the early F-104 Starfighter. So he said, wonderful movie. So thanks for that. And then, okay, back to something I referenced earlier. Our faithful listener Tom wrote in, and actually this was from a few weeks ago, he sent this in. You know, when I was reading the list to myself before the show, the list of companies that had sent that letter to the Congress, the last one in the list was a Vertical Aviation International. And I thought, I never heard of Vertical Aviation International. And so just by chance, I'm getting caught up on Tom's email, and he sent a link to an article in AIN Online. And which says that the, or it notes that the 35th anniversary edition of Heli Expo set a new record attendance, attracting 15,000 people. That was held at the Anaheim Convention Center in California. And then it goes on, a major point on the eve of the event was the change of its organizer's name from Helicopter Association International, right? That's the HAI that everybody knows, to Vertical Aviation International, VAI, to better reflect its embrace of the growing UAV and AAM segments. AAM being Advanced Air Mobility. Right. So I thought that was kind of interesting that, you know, this new organizational name shows up, and at the same time, you know, Tom points out that they've changed their name to reflect the sort of the changing focus.
The urban air mobility this year was definitely Helicopter International has always been a big deal as far as the industry goes. And there is a lot of urban air mobility, autonomy, air mobility, however you want to say it, that are going to replace, supplement helicopters, etc. So they're trying to grow the tent. And we've seen that also. Originally, the other organizations around the helicopter industry have sort of gone ahead and embraced the urban air mobility in the UAS because they are parallel technologies. So it's not surprising. It's just going to be a kind of change the Helicopter Flight Society that we have a relationship with became the Vertical Flight Society because they're talking more about all sorts of that kind of technology that's out there. So good luck to VAI. I'm sure that, you know, they're looking for a place to throw money, and you're part of the VII organization. I got a great museum for you.
There you go. Hey, it also changes the name of their show. So everyone's always known about Heli Expo for many, many years, and now it's going to be called Verticon. And I also read that they spent about 2 years kind of working through the whole issues of what do you call the organization, how to rebrand it, and so on. So they didn't take this lightly, but I think it makes great sense for positioning themselves for the future.
Yeah, it does make a whole lot of sense, actually.
It's kind of like the Air Force Association rebranding to the Air and Space Force Association.
Yes, yes. You got to change with the times, right?
That's right.
Got to stay current. All right. Well, we want to thank you all for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. We especially want to thank our guest this episode, Colonel Aaron Dick. again, Aaron, thanks so much. Do you have anything you want to plug? Any social media places that you hang out or anything that our listeners might be interested in?
Yeah, I tend to still hang out on the site formerly known as Twitter, because that is where my community still is. And I am just at Aaron Dick. And then I would love to connect on LinkedIn with anybody out there who would be interested. You can just do a search on Aaron Dick and you will find me. And the more av geeks in my life, the happier I am. So I look forward to connecting with as many of you as possible.
Very cool. All right.
And it's Aaron on Twitter from where I learn all about the Brooklyn Dodgers. I'm sorry, the Los Angeles Dodgers.
This is right. March 20th is opening day. Yes, that's the final plug.
There we go. All right. And you can find us at airplanegeeks.com, of course. The direct link to the show notes for this episode is at the shortcut we have, the permanent shortcut, airplanegeeks.com/791. That's the episode number. And our email address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. All right. David Vanderhoof, anything closing you'd like to mention?
Well, I'd like to invite Erin to see one of her old babies at my museum.
I have many old babies, so which one are you referring to?
We have the number 3 prototype V-22.
Oh, lovely. I will be on the next flight.
But yeah, we actually have a book club meeting on the 21st, as we record this, of March 21st, about Valerie, who was one of the very first women in the Whirly Girls, who was a one-man MASH helicopter pilot, and to the point where Valerie Andreas also was a professional surgeon. So not only did she airlift the airmen out of Vietnam, she actually got them back and operated on them. So very wow. Interesting woman. The other one is we have our friend for the show in April, Eileen Borkman, talking about her new book about women test pilots and women breaking the barrier of being pilots in the military. So those are the two upcoming book things. So, and of course, you could always just reach out to me at david@helicoptermuseum.org.
Cool. All right. And Max Trescott, how about you?
Oh, the usual place. You want to send me a note, just go to aviationnewstalk.com, click on contact at the top of the page. And as always, check out the Aviation News Talk podcast.
And Micah.
I am also still on the site formerly known as Twitter. I am at MaineFly, MAINE like the state, fly, let's go fly. And you can find me with Pasadena Brian Coleman on the Journey is a Reward podcast, and that's thejourneyisreward.org.
Very good. And you can find out where I hang out by visiting 30,000feet.com, all words spelled out. And we'll ask that you all please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
See you real soon.
And thanks for listening.
And go Dodgers!